So the name of this session is Innovations in Maternity Health Services, Global Practices. We have a very exciting group of presenters here. Our first one is going to be Laura Schlumers. Laura has, SM student. She is a master's student in epidemiology at Harvard School of Public Health. Laura studies birth outcomes and focuses on care for low-risk mothers and babies. Laura has previously worked as a research manager for the Midwifery Division of the University of British Columbia and as a research assistant in the OBGYN department at UBC and in the newborn medicine department at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Laura?
Thank you for the introduction, Carol. Today, I will discuss methods of fetal health surveillance and will describe our pilot study of a new method, the Movement and Pulse Index, or MAPI. I'd like to acknowledge two of my co-authors that are in the room, Sarah Vatham and Lisa Payne, as well as K.S. Joseph, who's not here today. And we have no financial disclosures to report, despite not having a slide that says so. I'd like to start by providing a brief overview of the methods of fetal surveillance that are currently used. Fetal surveillance methods aim to assess fetal well-being and the status of the uterine environment. The goal is to prevent stillbirth, neonatal death, and other adverse neonatal outcomes by identifying fetuses at high risk. Based on the results of fetal surveillance tests, clinicians and patients will consider expectant management of pregnancy or early delivery by induction of labor or cesarean section. The challenge is how to balance the potentially adverse effects of early delivery against the increasing risk of stillbirth, neonatal death, or other adverse outcomes. Currently recommended for those pregnancies with risk factors for these adverse outcomes, the most commonly used fetal surveillance methods are the non-stress test, the amniotic fluid index, the biophysical profile, and fetal movement counting. Of the less commonly used tests, I will only discuss the auscultated acceleration test today and will not go over the contraction stress test or Doppler velocimetry. I'd be happy to tell you why later. The non-stress test, which uses an electronic fetal monitor to trace the fetal heart rate, is by far the most widespread surveillance method in use today. The tracing is read to measure the baseline heart rate and variability and to count accelerations and decelerations of the fetal heart rate. The relative importance and interpretation of each of those parameters is not very clear. Also not clear is the optimal length of the test. In most clinics, if a normal result is not achieved in the first 20-minute interval, the test continues for another 20 minutes to a maximum of 80 minutes. How to treat these serial tests has not been evaluated. The most striking shortcoming of this test is the false positive rate. Reports range from 55 to 90%. Which are pretty staggering numbers. The amniotic fluid index is the next most commonly used test. This index sums the deepest vertical pocket in the four uterine quadrants, and the result is a volume that's measured in centimeters. What is considered to be a positive test is controversial. Most clinics these days use less than 4 or less than 5 centimeters to define a positive test, while others suggest a higher number, such as 7.5 centimeters. The predictive value of one cutoff versus another has not been evaluated in the literature. As it's currently used, the amniotic fluid index is not a strong predictor of neonatal outcomes and is associated with increased use of obstetric interventions. The biophysical profile combines the non-stress test and amniotic fluid test results with ultrasound measures of fetal tone and movement. The weighting of these parameters was arbitrarily set at the development of this test in the 80s to be equal, with scores ranging from 0 to 2 for each parameter, and no other weighting schemes have been considered. At 50%, the false positive rate of this test is also pretty high. The modified biophysical profile is used in some settings, which only looks at the non-stress test and amniotic fluid test results, with similar problems and a false positive rate of 60%. Neither profile score, the modified or the full biophysical, is better able to predict outcomes than the non-stress test alone. Fetal movement counting is actually probably the most widely used method, but hasn't really been seen as a test per se. The use of this method is really variable. There are two overarching approaches that have been used. One is the general awareness method, where women are instructed to contact their provider if they perceive a general decrease in movements over time. The other is the alarm limit or cut point approach, in which women are instructed to contact their care provider if they perceive less than this given number of movements in some specified time period. The interesting thing is that the specified movements and time periods vary from place to place, and they can't all be true. Like, you can have looking at 6 movements in 2 hours, 10 movements in 2 hours, or 4 movements all day. Those are inconsistent. It looks like there is some benefit of using one of the fetal movement counting approaches, but there's no evidence to say which method is better to use, and so this inconsistency in practice continues. The auscultated acceleration test is a low-technology alternative or version of the non-stress test. For a 6-minute period, the fetal heart rate is auscultated using a handheld fetoscope or Doppler to measure the same parameters that the non-stress test measures. The auscultator records the fetal heart rate in 5-second intervals onto the AAT chart, which you see on the right. And that kind of shows a tracing over time, just like the non-stress test does. In the development studies of this test, the test performed better than the non-stress test with a 75 versus 38% sensitivity and 72 versus 90% false positive rate. The AAT is inexpensive, easy to use, and could serve as an alternative in low-resource settings, or possibly high-resource settings if it actually performs better. The development studies of this test have been successfully replicated in Zimbabwe and China. And the test may hold promise, but like these other tests that we've talked about, it really hasn't been evaluated enough to recommend widespread use at this time. In summary, there's little evidence to support the use of any of the current fetal surveillance methods, and the optimal method is really unclear. Current methods fail to identify fetuses at risk for stillbirth or adverse outcomes. If we look at this from an ecological study perspective, which has flaws, but it's pretty much all we have to look at right now, where we compare the outcomes before these tests were introduced to the outcomes after these tests were introduced, the risk of the outcomes that the tests are supposed to prevent, stillbirth, neonatal death, and other adverse outcomes, have not decreased in this time period. And over the same time period, we've seen a rise in obstetric interventions, and specifically, this is early delivery by induction or cesarean section. In this time period, we've seen an increase in the risk of late preterm birth from 34 to 36 weeks, and much of this is thought to be attributable to iatrogenic delivery based on some risk factor. So some of these iatrogenic deliveries represent the false positives of the tests that we just looked at. And we just saw that the false positive rate of each of these is really high. All of these shortcomings were summarized in a really interesting issue in Seminars in Perinatology by an NIH consensus panel in 2009. And the conclusion from this panel was that researchers should examine each of the methods that are used and should try to develop new and better methods. In an attempt to address the shortcomings of these tests, we propose to develop a new method. Our review of the literature led us to conclude that measures of fetal behavior and fetal oxygenation are the most predictive indicators of fetal well-being, and that how best to measure fetal behavior remains largely unexplored. So what we will do is consider a vast number of individual test parameters, such as the heart rate or number of accelerations in the non-stress test, and use prediction modeling statistical methods to determine which parameters are true predictors of adverse pregnancy outcomes and to assign a weight to each of those predictors as far as how well that predictor predicts the outcome. The result will be 2 clinical prediction models. The first is the movement and pulse index, or MAPI, which will consider parameters from all the available tests and would be applicable in high resource settings. And the second is mobile MAPI, which will only look at parameters from low technology tests that could be applicable in low resource international or rural and remote settings. For our pilot study, we brought together a team of clinicians and researchers from the Women's Hospital in Vancouver, British Columbia, which is a tertiary care and provincial referral center. Women of 30 or more weeks of gestation were recruited from the maternal fetal medicine clinic during visits for non-stress tests. Our primary outcome was moderate to severe neonatal morbidity, which we measured by the Morbidity Assessment Index for Newborn Scale, or the MAIN score. This index combines 47 neonatal morbidity items with a weighting structure based on the relative importance and severity of each. Scores range from 0 to 6,000, and 500 or above indicates moderate to severe morbidity. Standard tests, the non-stress test, amniotic fluid index, and biophysical profile were performed according to the hospital's standard of care. And in addition, our research midwife performed 2 6-minute auscultated acceleration tests simultaneous to the non-stress test, and participants completed daily and weekly fetal movement and behavior logs, which we developed following a focus group with an expert panel of midwives in Vancouver. This is a screenshot of the fetal behavior and movement log, and on the right you see some of the types of parameters that we were looking at. We aim to explore some of the measurable aspects of fetal behavior that go beyond simple movement counting. And so the logs included these qualitative descriptions of perceived movements like kick versus squirm versus roll, perceived strength of movement, and other patterns in movement such as establishment of sleep-wake cycles or hiccups. We recruited 51 women over 8 weeks. Excluding those that were lost to follow-up, we have data for 48 participants. Due to the varying length of follow-up time, we have a different number of tests for each participant. In this analysis, to avoid problems of non-independence between observations, I'm only going to discuss the last test or log. The mean maternal age and BMI and gestational age of delivery were similar in our sample as the population averages. And as expected, cesarean delivery was more common among newborns with adverse outcomes, as well as NICU admission and length of stay. There's a lot to look at here. I'm just going to breeze through this one quickly. To show that this is just an example of what we might do with a larger sample in the full study. We could look at the number and types of movements by gestational age to see if some threshold or descriptor is predictive of either an adverse or a good outcome. This slide really presents the main findings of our pilot, so I'm going to spend a few minutes here. As I explained, the objective of the full study was to develop these clinical prediction models. This would be with 1,800 participants. With 48 participants, any meaningful prediction or regression modeling just isn't possible. But we could look at the performance of each of the component tests to mimic some of the methods that we would use to develop the clinical prediction model with a full sample. For example, discrimination is usually the first performance measure that is evaluated when you develop a new clinical prediction model. Discrimination is the ability of a model or a test to separate cases from non-cases, which you would normally see presented as the C statistic or the area under the ROC curve. That is actually a function of sensitivity and specificity. In case anyone's a little bit rusty, just a refresher, the sensitivity is the probability of a positive test among cases, and specificity is the probability of a negative test among non-cases. So by looking at the sensitivity and specificity for each test and combining tests changes these performance measures, we can see an example of how we would evaluate a more complex model in the future. So looking at the table, the 0% sensitivity of the non-stress test means that none of the cases had an atypical or abnormal non-stress test. Keep in mind, there are only 4 cases, so these peculiar findings likely represent our small sample size. For some tests, there's variability between practice settings in terms of what is called a positive test. I explained this earlier regarding fetal movement alarm limits and amniotic fluid index results. So if we look at the amniotic fluid index results in this table, you can see these 3 different cutoffs. Because the cutoffs are controversial, we looked at 3 that were recommended by the maternal fetal medicine specialist on our team. In our setting, less than 5 or 4 is what constitutes a positive test. If we had used this definition in our sample, then the sensitivity would also be 0%, which would mean that none of our cases would have had a positive test. If we move the cutoff to less than 7.5 centimeters, 2 of the 3 cases who underwent this type of testing would have had a positive test, though doing so also drops the specificity by 20%. If we move the cutoff further to 10 centimeters, we see no added improvement in sensitivity, and the specificity drops even further. So playing with the definition of what a positive test is brings up an interesting point. We, as clinicians and researchers, have a choice about where these cutoffs should actually be. And what a good or a bad test is and where this cutoff should be depends on what the implications for a false negative test are and the implications for a false positive test. As the sensitivity of a test increases, the percentage of false negative tests decreases. That is, if they sum to 100% of the cases. Similarly, as the specificity increases, the false positive percentage decreases because specificity plus false positive tests equal 100% of the non-cases. In our case, a false negative test will lead to expectant management of a pregnancy that may benefit from intervention, early delivery, and a false positive test may lead to an unnecessary induction or cesarean delivery. So as we determine which cutoff to use, we need to weigh the impact of false positive and false negative results, and we may not all agree about how to prioritize these implications. Back to the table, we played similarly with defining positive tests for the auscultated acceleration test and fetal movement and behavior parameters. We found that as the development team thought, the auscultated acceleration test performed better when we looked at 2 6-minute tests as a single test instead of only one 6-minute period. And then moving down to the fetal movement and behavior tests, hiccups had what might be a surprisingly high sensitivity and decent specificity. Even more impressive was the no strong movements test, which means that none of the movements in the 20-minute period under study were perceived to be strong. That had the highest sensitivity of all tests in our sample of 4 adverse outcomes, and it had a reasonable specificity. On the other hand, the simple movement counting test, which is the only fetal behavior test ever used in clinical practice, yet again, had a 0% sensitivity. So in summary, from what we found, the amniotic fluid test at less than 7.5 centimeters, the 2 6-minute auscultated acceleration test hiccups, and no strong movements seem to perform best. To distinguish between or select these, we may need more information about the implications for each of these, and we would clearly need a bigger sample size. By selecting only one test, we're not really mimicking true practice in which multiple tests are used to triangulate information regarding a fetus's status, though usually in an ad hoc fashion. So next, we looked at just simple pairwise combinations of the tests to see how the sensitivity and specificity might change. In all cases, the sensitivity increased and specificity improved somewhat as well. These were combined very simply and really don't mimic what we would do in a large-scale prediction model setting, but do provide just an example of the framework that we would use to approach this. Next steps, clearly our priority is to secure funding for the implementation of a full-scale study. We're considering partitioning some components of the study, such as refining the logs in a low-risk midwifery population in order to establish a normal baseline of what fetal behavior should look like. And though we can't draw any conclusions about the utility of these tests from our data at this point, we do consider the pilot to have been a great success. We found that feasibility of looking at all of these parameters was there. We had buy-in from all of our clinical partners. We were able to recruit women. They were willing to fill out the logs. All of that worked, which was really exciting. And though very preliminary, the fact that the performance of these novel measures did as well or better than the tests that are currently used made us at least conclude that these deserve a bit more attention in the literature. Thank you. I'd just like to thank the Nellie Auersperg Award in Women's Health that provided funding for our pilot and the rest of our co-investigator and research support staff team. Thank you.